Good evening and welcome. It's KVC Arts. Arts and entertainment as well as the people and places providing it. I'm David Fleming. Later in the program, we'll be revisiting a favorite interview from the past, Lillian Vasquez, in conversation with Richard Sherman. With that, we will naturally be touching on Disney, and of course, with that, some very familiar tunes. We are starting the program with a new book, From the Moon As I Fell, a collection of poems with reflections on Joshua Tree. KVCR's Benjamin Perper has more. First, though, a reminder, from now until December 31st, all sales of From the Moon As I Fell, as well as from another one of Henley's books, will be donated to the California Fire Foundation's SAVE program.
I'm here with Eli Henley and Zara Kand. Can you introduce yourself for me, please? And we'll start with Lauren.
Well, I always start by saying where I'm from, Joshua Tree. I live in 29 Palms now, which of course is right next to Joshua Tree. I very much consider myself a desert writer, a desert artist. The desert informs so much of my imagination and my creativity. I teach, although it seems sort of occasional at this point due to COVID. I'm married to a wonderful musician and writer named Jonathan Moll. And I got a really cool buddy named Zara.
My name is Zara Kand. I also live in Joshua Tree. I spend most of my time oil painting. I consider my style to be symbolism. I am a private chef. That pretty much sums up what takes up most of my time here in the desert. And of course, hanging out with awesome Lauren.
Did you grow up in the desert, Zara?
I did not. I've lived all over the place. I've been living in the desert for the last 5.5 years.
Okay, cool. And the desert very much is a part of this collection, right? How does it show up in the work?
It definitely screams the desert. You can feel that in Lauren's vivid descriptions of the animal and wildlife. The visual aspect, it's laden with, you know, desert landscapes and whatnot. We definitely try to give very much a desert feel in this work. Wouldn't you say, Lauren?
Oh yeah, absolutely. It's very much rooted in the poems and in the paintings. All of our images are set in the desert. And the neat thing about having your images set in the desert is that the desert so easily transforms into any imaginative landscape that you can conceive of, because it is so wide open, because we have these moonlit nights, because we can see the stars so well and the plants are so strange that it can just very easily take on this otherworldly. A lot of people compare it to the moon, even though there's nothing on the moon and there's a lot here. There's a lot here. So that's a pretty cool thing about the desert is, depending on how you're looking at it, it can become something new.
Yeah, it's like a wide open canvas. Anything can be expressed within all the little crevices and just the openness.
Yeah, I'm thinking of the jackrabbits that show up so much in this book. Can you kind of speak to why that is?
Sure, I'll go first on that one. I've been thinking about these jackrabbits, and okay, it really started for me with the first time that a jackrabbit caught me off guard in such a way that it appeared to me as a small child. I had this, you know, just a couple of seconds, I was like, oh my God, there's a little child. The way that they hunch and the way that they sit is very much like a curved back of a young child sort of looking at something on the ground. And I'm looking out into this Choya field that is my backyard. And, oh my God, there's a kid out there. And so for me, the jackrabbit, and it catches me off guard often where I'm like, is that a dog? What is out there? It's quite large for not being a predator. It catches me off guard and I feel like I'm seeing something different almost every time I see one. And it kind of brings out this motherly instinct in me that I'm like, oh my goodness, there's something out there that needs my help. And Zara painted the jackrabbit just beautifully. She painted the jackrabbit of my dreams in this book.
I wanted to, because you seem to have such a strong affinity for rabbits. And I relate to all of what you said about them just now.
So you two have collaborated before. I'm thinking of the reading for Whole Night Through, which is one of Lauren's books. But how did this collaboration come about?
Yeah, we have collaborated several times. We've done a frastic poetry and painting exchanges, which is always great. And when COVID hit, when we found ourselves in the beginning of quarantine, I think we were because of all those unsettling feelings, we had to turn that into creativity somehow. And we both found out that we were creating some works, just kind of dealing with those new emotions, and decided that we should turn it into something constructive and work together and produce some kind of booklet that maybe could inspire other people during this time.
Yeah, I think Zara summed that up beautifully. And I will just add that since people can't see the book right in front of them right now, it is a full color chat book. We originally were thinking, okay, we'll make a little booklet, a community offering. And then that turned into, no, let's make the best quality thing that we possibly can and still make it a community offering and use it to raise money, which we'll talk about later on. But it's a really beautiful book.
It is a very beautiful book. And COVID-19 is very much present in it. I mean, you mentioned the virus several times explicitly. How does it inform the work?
Well, I think as Zara mentioned, it spurred us. Being in quarantine spurred us into action to seize the moment and do this collaboration. But I think I can speak for both of us when I say that we wanted to express some of the anxiety of the moment, and not just our own, but try to express the general anxiety that, you know, everybody all over the world was feeling. But each poem, either explicitly or implicitly, has to do with emotions, the emotions that arrive from the virus.
So you describe these poems and paintings as emotional landscapes. What does that mean exactly?
I like to describe it as whatever intense inner world that you're experiencing, that's then being shown in a way that others can understand. So it's a highly personal interpretation put into a way that's put onto your environment. And it's more that the story is being told by the emotion rather than the specifics.
Yeah, I think that's a great explanation there. And what's so interesting, I think, about this idea of an emotional landscape is it goes both ways. So it's translating the emotion into the landscape, and it's also translating the landscape into an emotion, but the images are rooted in the flora and the fauna and the landscape of the desert. This is a book that really focuses on symbols and things, very much full of nouns, and those nouns are rooted in the desert landscape.
And the poems are relatively short, which isn't to say that they're not vivid themselves or beautiful in themselves, but Zara, how did you create such vivid paintings from relatively small amounts of text?
Yeah, they are definitely very rich. You know, they're very concentrated. So she would send me a poem and I would then create an image based on that. And I'd definitely have to read through them several times. The first time being just absorbing the feeling, and that would give me the foundation that I'd be working with. And then I'd go back and pay attention to the details and the symbols in her poems and then apply them in a visual way. It was a lot of back and forth. I definitely had to spend a lot of time with each poem.
Yeah, I was just always really impressed at how Zara was able to do that. I'd be like, oh, here's a strange one. What are you going to do with that? I was always so impressed at how she would capture the emotion of the poem. And also just so glad that our styles went together so well, that we were both going for sort of strange and dreamy and brief, but saying a lot with a little.
I would add that these images are actually done in very much a different style than I normally work with. When you look at my other bodies of works, they're definitely sharper images. And for this body of work, I wanted to go with a more dreamy kind of loose feel. I just felt that that was appropriate for these emotional landscapes.
Definitely. And what about the feminist element in all of this? Can you kind of speak to that?
Yeah, I would say that we both recognize that feminist art, it should acknowledge what we are rather than what we aren't. And that being empowering all aspects of ourselves. So for this series, we wanted to show that when times are tough, it's more about what you do rather than say how you're suffering. And we wanted to create a really beautiful thing out of all of this. And I feel that we did that. We spoke to the vulnerabilities and took the weaknesses that we were feeling, but turned them into strengths.
Beautifully said. Yeah, I agree with that. Just the making. I think that women have always had to make do with limited resources, and they've had to stretch groceries, stretch time, stretch energy, stretch. And, you know, you have the speaker who does feel very much responsible, has a sense of anxiety for the suffering that is around her, and is very sort of conscientious and aware, but also allowing herself to go through her own ups and downs.
And there's a lot of like self-reliance in this, isn't there?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the very act of making a book or making any kind of art or music or building a house, making something during a very difficult time is an act of resiliency and self-reliance, but also making alliances with so much division when it's possible to work with someone else or a group of someone else's, even if it, I mean, we weren't able to physically get in the room together. So we had to work that out. It was all through the computer, but, you know, we reached out toward each other and built something. And I think that speaks volumes of self-reliance and of relying on others as well when you need to.
There's so much that you can do with creativity. It opens up worlds.
You're listening to KVC Arts on 91.9 KVCR, streaming at kvcrnews.org. I'm David Fleming. Many past shows can be found through iTunes, Spotify, NPR One, and Google Play, and all past shows are at kvcrnews.org/arts. Also, you can tell your smart speaker to play KVCR. Let's go now back to KVCR's Benjamin Perper in conversation with L.I. Henley, author of From the Moon As I Fell, a collection of poems of and from around Joshua Tree. We'll also hear from the illustrator, Zara Kond. And a reminder once again that from now until December 31st, all sales of From the Moon As I Fell, as well as sales from another one of Henley's books, the proceeds will be donated to the California Fire Foundation's SAVE program. More at lihenley.com, lihenley.com.
So you had to go through the computer for all this. Like you said, you couldn't meet up in person, really. So how did isolation inform this process of creating this chapbook?
We definitely had plenty of time to sit with ourselves and kind of stew in our emotions and just trying to make sense of what was going on in the outer world and just imagining all the confusion that everyone else must have been feeling. And so, yeah, creating this book was sort of like also an attempt to create a bridge between ourselves and others and what we imagined as this state of anxiety that the world at large was experiencing and still is. So, yeah, a lot of the themes you see in the book are definitely about a lot of self-reflection and reflecting on the world at large.
And so the desert can be isolating itself even before COVID-19. How has COVID-19 changed life in the desert?
I'll jump on that one. I think Zara will back me up here when I say that our little town is fairly busy and has been lots and lots of visitors. So I'm sort of answering this question maybe in a way that you might not expect, right? But you think of the desert as being, you know, isolated and quiet, and it still is in a lot of ways. And yet, understandably so, since quarantine started, people have been fleeing more populated areas and wanting to come out to the desert, renting Airbnbs and filling up the campgrounds every available spot. And downtown Joshua Tree is very, very busy and populated. Now, this is good in some ways because our small businesses have really been suffering. So I'm not saying it's all bad. I'm just saying it doesn't feel actually as isolated as perhaps it did at one point. But you can still find, I think, solitude out here. There's still enough room to do that. And I personally, you know, I don't live in a neighborhood out here. I have space around me. And so I still get to experience that quiet. And I think plenty of us still do. But the town is definitely teeming with visitors right now.
Yeah, that's exactly put. I mean, I think it's busier this year than it's ever has been. So people, I understand wanting to escape whatever crowded environment you're in, to go to a more isolated place and you feel like you're maybe safer that way. But yeah, that's not really the case when everybody's doing it. So it's interesting. But sadly, a lot of businesses out here have gone out of business. We've seen those changes. A lot of the smaller mom and pop shops have gone out of business. So that's sad to see. And it'll be interesting to see how the town resuscitates itself in that regard when this is all over.
All right. Can you read some poetry for us?
I'd love to. From the Moon, As I Fell, poems by L.I. Henley and paintings by Zara Khand. Eyes open, I begin, a stone in the roots of a catclaw tree. That was just this morning. Each day brings the threat of rebirth. The mantra, get it right, pleated into my skirt. If I ever was part of a litter, they surely left no trace. Sometimes I sing, ollie ollie oxen free, into the damp beneath yellow pepper grass and wait.
Slung, as in hasty delivery, as in catapult, time. A luxury reserved for saints and rivers. I am in a mood today. There is a virus killing the elderly, the compromised, and I am among the compromised. Aren't we all? Aren't we all? Many of us feel starry-headed, lobbed in the ice plant, speared 6 feet apart. This tingle, this pulled thread, our arms outstretched. Maybe we miss each other. Maybe we've never been closer.
Soft pummel of another morning overslept. I am as dense, as low, as gray as peyote, unable to name the range of mountains right in front of me. Thankfully, I still know how to ration. Thankfully, there's more coffee. The president calls the virus an invisible enemy, like weevils in the rice. Arsenic in the dust. It's been there how long now, that dark figure on the outcrop of granite?
First sight, a fish hook in bloom, the fruit long, smooth, red among the gravel. Mammillaria, as in nipple-like, as in mama is awake now, mother of what's to come. Every time I raise my eyes, the sky has changed. Following rainy periods, the landscape is marked by brilliant flourishes, which sounds like feverish, rainfall prolonged. It feels like drowning, they said.
Clay, gypsum, mica, sandstone. These are certainties ingredients, but they do nothing to fill a belly or keep a mind afloat. Headline, 100 ways to cook beans. Pinto, black-eyed, cranberry, navy. Pick out the stones, wash, shove your hands deep into the bowl.
And singe is yet another word for burn, though less destructive, and sometimes fixes what's been frayed. Burn lightly the desert sage. I'll make a smudge bowl of my abalone hands. If we are lonely, at least we are feeling. Make a gift of your burdens. Give to me that ragged bouquet.
Wind on brittle bush sounds like the last time you whispered to a stranger in a crowded theater, excuse me, sorry, sorry. Now I want to know, what did all of those knees I brushed against feel like? Some petals are so achingly soft, like touching nothing at all.
Saltbush, winter fat, crow's feet at the eyes, In my dreams, I'm always 20-something, hard-bodied, roving, lonely hills. There is no field guide for desire, no entry to tell me, this is a devil's claw, and this is a whispering bell, and this one will go dormant, and this one catches fire in the slightest breeze.
For me, for you, the folded note of daylight. It's true. The wildflowers will leave without fanfare, silently and in waves. I'll be eating breakfast or sorting beans when the last one blinks out. It will be almost painless. For you, for me, there will be more wild things, fires, flowers, more. I get out of bed, open the blinds. I wave to you from my porch.
Beautiful. Thank you. I wish people could see the paintings, but I guess that's the limits of radio. So
that's why they must check out the book.
Yeah. And how do we do that? How can listeners buy the book?
There are a couple different ways, through both of our websites and through local stores. I'll start by giving you my website. Sorry, I can give you hers and tell you about the stores. So my website is just lihenley.com.
And you can find it also on my website, zarakond.com. It's also available online through Space Cowboy Books bookshop.org page. And for those of you that don't know what bookshop.org is, it's a wonderful alternative to buying new books online as opposed to buying them on Amazon. And the authors are able to profit better through this system. So anytime you want to buy a new book, definitely check out bookshop.org.com.
And sales will be donated to the California Fire Foundation's SAVE program, right? What is that?
Yeah, so it's a program that gives essentially like cash gift cards. They're just as good as cash for people who have been negatively affected by the California wildfires, either lost their homes or whatever their situation is. And I found this program, it was on a list of like reliable charities that you know the money is actually going to get to the people. I found it on the New York Times and it's highly rated. And so that's part of why Zara and I chose this this program for our book sales to go to. And so between when the book came out a couple months ago and December 31st, all funds are going there. So I think we've raised about $200 so far. It'd be really awesome to double that by December 31st so we can help out as many people as possible.
That was L.I. Henley, author of From the Moon as I Fell, a collection of poetry from and of Joshua Tree. We also heard from Zara Kond, providing beautiful illustrations. They were in conversation with KVCR's Benjamin Perper. Again, more at lihenley.com. That's lihenley.com. Also, you really should check out more of Zara's work. That's at zarakond.com, zarakand.com. And a reminder once again that from now until December 31st, from all sales of From the Moon as I Fell and one of Henley's previous books, Whole Night Through, proceeds will be donated to the California Fire Foundation SAVE program. Let's go now to some of your favorites from the world of Disney. The small world of Disney, if you will. Here's KVCR's Lillian Vasquez.
Richard Sherman is an award-winning songwriter who for many years worked as a team with his brother Robert. Together, they were Disney. Some of your best-known writings include songs from Mary Poppins, The Jungle Book, Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, Winnie the Pooh, and well-known amusement park theme, It's a Small World. Now, let me ask you about that. That was actually for the New York World's Fair, is that right?
Actually, yes, it was back in 1964, I believe it was the World's Fair, and we were asked to come in and write a song. It was sort of a unification song where they were going to salute the children of the world, and it was sponsored by UNICEF. The concept was that these little groups of animatronic dolls would sing national anthems of the various countries. And unfortunately, that is on paper very brilliant and in actuality terrible. It became a mess. And so my brother Bob and I were staff writers at the Walt Disney Studio. And Walt Disney asked us to come down and see this thing. And then we realized what a mess it was. And he said, I need a little simple song that talks about the small children of the world, the hope of the future. And I don't want it to be preachy. I want it to be kind of a fun song. And so Bob and I wrote a gentle little song with a contrapuntal melody that could be played together or separately in various styles and sung in any language. This was the song that we wrote, and we just thought it would be nice for this ride, never dreaming that it caught on so well that they brought it back to Disneyland, and now it's in all the Disney parks, and it's perhaps the most performed song on earth.
And I think it's in everybody's mind when they get there, when they're there, and when they leave, and they just can't get it.
I hope that the message comes through, because it is a small world after all, so we should live together in peace and harmony. That's what the whole idea of the song is. They want to even kiss us or kill us for writing that song because they can't get it out of their heads.
That's very true. Let me ask you, how did you come to know Walt Disney?
Oh, well, that was because of a little girl named Annette Funicello. Oh. Annette was a Mouseketeer.
The Mickey Mouse Club?
Wonderful, talented kids. And Annette was one of the most loved of all the children on that show. When the show was over, they wanted to feature her. She was so popular that they would feature her on records. And she happened to sing a song of ours called Tall Paul. And Tall Paul became a huge hit for her. And so we were asked to write more songs for Annette, not knowing that Walt Disney was, she was his pet. I mean, he loved her. And so a little 14-year-old, 15-year-old Annette Funicello became our lucky break, because Walt Disney started loving our songs. He heard a lot of songs we wrote for her, and eventually invited us into the studio to start writing some songs for him. And that's how it all started.
Wow.
Now it's time to say goodbye to all our company. M-I-C.
See you real soon.
K-E-Y.
Why? Because we like you.
M-O-U.
Now, Mary Poppins is an all-time favorite of mine personally. Will you share with me the experience writing the songs, working with P.L. Travers, but more specifically also Julie Andrews and my favorite Dick Van Dyke? And just for the record, I love Dick Van Dyke's accent in the movie, just for the record.
Well, Dick, you know, he said he never could master that Cockney, which he didn't, but he was Dick Van Dyke. He's unique, and he did his own thing, and he did it beautifully. I will say this, working with Julie and Dick was a joy, but the big, big hurdle for Bob and myself was licking that book, getting something out of a series of stories that had no point. If you read the Mary Poppins books, they're charming, they're brilliant, it's an inventive character, this wonderful personality of Mary Poppins, and add up to a series of adventures. But there is no need for Mary Poppins to come. There's no need for her to leave. And Mrs. Travers was enigmatic. She never let us in on any reasons. She said, oh, you make them up yourself. So when Bob and I were given this book, not knowing Mrs. Travers at all, but just knowing the books, our big problem was, when we read this book, let's make a story. And so Bob and I sort of took six of the key chapters we thought were very good in the first book. We were just given the first Mary Poppins book. And we wove them together with the need for Mary Poppins to come. That was never put in the original books. There's a dysfunctional family called the Banks family. And so we made the father too busy working at the bank to pay attention to his kids. The mother was too occupied with her cause. She was a suffragette, so she never paid any attention to the kids. So Mary Poppins is needed. And as soon as we got that, we said, oh, now we have a reason to tell these stories. And little life lessons can be learned from it. So they're gentle life lessons about it doesn't take much to give love. That was all brought out in Feed the Birds, Tuppence a Bag. It doesn't have to do much to do a wonderful thing, to be kind, to be loving. That was one. And you have to have a happy attitude about doing things. so that a tough job is easy. So we did a spoonful of sugar to help the medicine go down. These are all things that came out of our need to make a storyline. And that was one of the things that we built. And everything that we came up with when we finally had that meeting with Mrs. Travers, which is dramatized in the recent movie called Saving Mr. Banks, she despised everything we came up with. Why? Because she didn't write it.
But could she see what you were trying to do and what your team was trying to do by taking her works? Could she get there with that, or she just wouldn't have anything?
We said in our thousands that we're not changing your books. Your books will always be there. We're inspired by the books to do a movie, and a movie has to have a plot. And she said, there's no plot. It's self-realized. And we said, but people sitting in a chair have to be glued to that thing to find out what's going to happen. You have to have a climax, a denouement. You have to have that moment. And she just didn't like it. She just didn't like it. The only thing that she ever liked, and we dramatized that in the movie, Saving Mr. Banks, she liked the fact that the father mends the kite and flies it with the kids. That she liked.
In the rest of the world, you got everything right in Mary Poppins.
Well, that's very kind of you, because we were very proud of it, and I know Walt loved it. He loved the picture, and he was very proud of it. But now you're talking about Julie Andrews and Dick Van Dyke. In my opinion, they were born to play these parts. We're having a heck of a time trying to figure out how to cast Mary Poppins, because that's obviously a key character in the whole piece. And we were looking at different actors, and they were all wonderful actresses. And one night, I happened to be watching the Ed Sullivan Show, and Julie was on the show with Richard Burton doing a song from Camelot called What Do the Simple Folk Do?
What do the simple folk do to help them escape when they're blue? The shepherd who is ailing, the milkmaid who is glum, the cobbler who is wailing from nailing his thumb. When they're beset and besieged, the folk not noblessly obliged, however do they manage to shed their weary lot? Oh, what do simple folk do?
And as soon as I saw her start to sing that thing, I said, my God, that's Mary Poppins. She's fantastic, and she's perfect. And look, she whistles, too, because we were going to do a whistling thing with Spoonful of Sugar. And so I called my brother, and he said, I can't talk to you now. I'm watching somebody that's perfect for Mary Poppins. I said, that's what I'm calling you about. It was while she was doing it. He said, oh, she's perfect. The next day we came in, and we saw Don. Don DeGrady was our collaborator. He was the guy that was key writer on the show, along with Bill Walsh, who wrote the brilliant dialogue. And so Don said, did you see it? I said, yes. And then we spoke to Walsh, and he saw it. We all were thrilled. We were going to tell Walt, and his secretary, Tommy Wilkes, said, don't tell Walt. He's going to New York. I'm going to have him see Camelot. I'm buying tickets for it, and he'll make up his own mind. So believe it or not, we were all sold with Julie before Walt ever saw her do Camelot. But he was so excited when he saw her, he went backstage afterwards and invited her to come out, and that's how it all started.
Wow. And did you write a particular song for her in Mary Poppins? I thought
yes.
I read something. What was that?
Well, actually, we had written a song called Through the Eyes of Love.
Right.
And it was a very beautiful ballad. And what it said was the exact same thing that we say in Spoonful of Sugar. Reality is what you want it to be. You can find beauty in almost anything if you try hard enough. And that was, in a sense, what it was all about. If you look at things through the eyes of love, they become beautiful. You can see in an ordinary person a beautiful, beautiful human being if you look at their soul. It was a very beautiful ballad. And when she heard the score, she loved everything, really, truly. But she confessed to Walt that Eyes of Love song, I don't know, it isn't in the spirit of Poppins. You should have something more crisp. It was her decision. And so Walt told us what Julie Andrews had said, and we said, well, okay, we were disappointed. You know, we said, oh, gosh, she didn't like our best song. And so we said, okay, we'll write something else. So we said, let's tell the same story in a different way with a slogan. And we were trying to think of what kind of a slogan, like an apple day keeps a doctor away. And you know, we just were thinking. And Bob's son came home from school one day, and Jeff, his name is, and Jeff said, Dad, we had the Salk vaccine. We had the polio vaccine today. And Bob said, did it hurt? He said, oh, no. They put the vaccine on a cube of sugar, and we took it down, and it was like candy, and it was good. And so Bob came in the next day and said, I got a title. And I said, what is it? He said, listen to this. A spoonful of sugar helps the medicine go down. I said, oh, that's terrible. Wait a second. No, that's great. It's great. It says it all without having to lay it on with a trowel. And that's where he said, okay, great. and we started working from that. And it was just a lot of fun. And then knowing Mary Poppins did things that you didn't expect. For example, she slid up banisters, things like that. So we said, well, every time the word down happens in the song, we'll go up with the tune. Just a spoonful of sugar helps the medicine go down. And said, oh, yes, that's it. That's it. That's Mary Poppins.
Wow.
That's how we wrote the song.
How wonderful. Thank you so much for sharing that story. In the movie Saving Mr. Banks, did you feel it captured it? It was very close.
Oh, definitely. I worked on the show as a consultant, and I had the pleasure of working with Kelly Marcel, the writer, and gave her a lot of these stories that I'm telling you. And she incorporated a lot of that, those things, those little incidents, into the screenplay.
Right.
And it was very true. She was very difficult. One day she marched in and says, I'm off the color red. I don't want red in the picture. I mean, come on. That's bananas, isn't it? Crazy. And we said, well, Mrs. Travis, for God's sake, the Union Jack has red in it. The post office boxes are red. The buses are red. Everything is red. What's the matter? And she said, I'm off red. I don't want red. And we couldn't talk to her. I mean, she was just... Believe me, make up your own mind, but she was not exactly like a normal person.
She wasn't the most friendly, as it appeared in Saving Mr. Banks. She wasn't open-minded by any means, was she?
No, she closed-minded. She almost felt as if her words were the words of the Lord and nothing else could change.
Right.
And I think one of the reasons why she disliked our story so much is because we made the father a human being and not just a fellow that went to the bank and made money and came home at night. Because her father... was, let's say, troubled human being,
right,
who was a drunkard, and he died when she was 8 years old. And she had this father fixation about he was just wonderful. And so we said, we didn't know any of this, of course, but we said, in order to have a story, let's have something wrong in the family. The father's too busy making money and everything to pay attention to his children. So we just made that up so we could have a story. And she resented it, and she never explained why or anything.
Right.
She just said she hated it.
Now, did she appreciate it after she saw millions of people love the movie? Was
That's
it any
a good
different?
Question. I'm sure she didn't.
Oh,
I'm
wow.
sure she felt we made money off of her Mary Poppins and we distorted the reality of Mary Poppins. Because in her books, that's the real Mary Poppins.
Oh.
Although thunderous amounts of people, including librarians in schools, loved our movie. They said, no, but it's not exactly the book. I said, yes, it isn't the book, because the book, she was a vinegar puss. She wasn't a lovable, sweet, wonderful lady who sang songs and everything. She didn't do those things. And so basically, we made a kind of a fun character. She was fun, was still kind of prim and proper and did her thing. But, yeah, it was a different world.
Then I think in the movie Saving Mr. Banks, I think she nailed the character.
Emma Thompson.
Yes,
she was
yes,
wonderful.
She was wonderful.
She
I thought
she was one of the
she...
best actresses in the business.
Yeah,
yes.
she did a dynamite job. Dick Van Dyke, wasn't one of the songs that he sang that won the Academy Award?
Oh, yes, Chim Chim Cheree. He's
right.
The one that did it. And that, again, was one of those wonderful things. There's a chapter in one of the later books of Mary Poppins that Don had read. We hadn't read it. And it was a chimney sweep walking down the street, and Mary Poppins shakes hands with him, and a little soot gets onto her fingers. And the children say, ooh, you got soot from the chimney sweep. She said, don't you know it's luck when you shake with a sweep? And so... basically, Don drew a picture of a chimney sweep walking down the street whistling, and underneath the picture he put in print, he said, it's luck when you shake with a sweep. And one day, Bob and I walked into Don's office, and we were talking about a point in the story, what we were working on, and we saw this picture. He said, what is this? He said, oh, there was this charming little character that is a chimney sweep, and they shake hands, and... we said, my God, what a great idea for a song. We like to write a chimney sweep song. So we created this song called Chim Chim Cheree, which is it's a playing with the word chimney. And it was a kind of a fun song. We liked it. And Walt heard it. He said, you know something? We have to make Bert, who is the sidewalk artist, a jack of all trades.
Yes.
Some days he's a chimney sweep. Some days he's a sidewalk artist. Some days he's a seller of kites because we're going to have a kite sequence. And some days he's just a rhymer. In the beginning, he sells rhymings. And he's a one-man band.
You know,
one-man band. This is all Walt Disney's dreams. Walt Disney was a genius, and nobody can ever take it away from him. He was great. He would take a good idea and make it great. So Walt truly created Bert, because Bert was just one little incidental character in one sequence. And Walt made Bert a jack of all trades, and so he was like Mary Poppins' earthly counterpart.
And
that was what it all was about. We created Bert for the picture.
Right, and I just can't see, as I think of many actors throughout the many decades, anybody else but Dick Van Dyke in his long, long-legged, his big, huge smile. I can't see anyone else having played that role any better or anyone else in it.
Well, I totally agree with you. I think he was superb. And what about that incredible dance ability?
He has,
you know, he's not a trained dancer, and yet he could do everything that those incredibly agile dancers did in the movie. He was just a wonderful, wonderful all-around talent. He sang beautifully, he acted beautifully, and he with all his heart, and he also danced incredibly well. I mean, it was just, he's a remarkable guy. I think we had two of the greatest people at that time in the world doing those two parts. And, of course, the picture is beloved, and I'm very proud of it. It's a high water mark in our lives. It was the doorway to our whole career. Listed a litany of pieces, but they all happened subsequent to Mary Poppins.
And I think children in decades to come will enjoy the music and the story of Mary Poppins. So thank you so much for that. I want to ask you a little bit. So many wonderful songs for adults and children are enjoyed, regardless if they won awards that you've written. And, of course, many of them did, or either nominated or did win awards. Who were you writing for? Were you writing for children? Who were you writing for other than Mr. Disney? Who did you have in mind?
You know, for many, many people. But when we're writing a song, we're writing for the character. When we're writing particularly a story song, we're writing to describe a personality, to describe a situation, to describe a place, a time. All these things are part and parcel of what we do. And what we try to do is make it as good as it can be for that particular story. And we never actually were thinking about, well, which is going to be the money song, which is going to go out and make all the things. We never, ever gave that a thought. All we did was try to perfect the storyline and to do it with songs that people will enjoy listening to or humming themselves.
And of the songs that you've written, do you have a favorite that stays in your mind? Because you've written so many, and I know that's kind of a cliche question to even ask, but just wondering, is there something in your heart that stays with you? Like Feed the Birds was for Walt Disney.
It is not a cliche question. It's an excellent question. And, you know, if you have 500 or 600 children, who's your favorite child?
Exactly.
It's very impossible to give you a total answer, but I'll say this. One of the most significant songs in my life was a song that we did for Mary Poppins called Feed the Birds, Tuppence a Bag.
Feed the birds, tuppence a bag.
It says a lot. It says it doesn't take much to give love. We never use those words in the song, but that's what it says. It says it doesn't take very much. Tuppence, which is 2 pennies, it's nothing. And buying a bag of crumbs, it has nothing to do with buying bags of crumbs. It has to do with a little kindness, a kind thought, giving love to your kids, taking them out, fly a kite with them, something like that. That's what a tuppence is. And all these meanings, we sort of try to pour it into the music and lyrics of this song. And when Walt first heard it, when we were just fledglings, before we actually were on the staff, and he heard that song, he said, play it again, you know, so he played it again. He said, that's the whole story, isn't it, in a nutshell? He said, that's right, Walt, that's right. And he said, well, how'd you like to work here? And he hired us that day. So
wow.
I think that got to me, that favorite.
Though her words are simple and few, listen, listen, she's calling to you. Feed the birds, tuppence a bag, tuppence, tuppence.
Let me ask, you joined Disney's team again because you were there in the early years, and then in the 70s you came back with Aristocrats, Bedknobs and Broomsticks, yeah. Many Adventures of Winnie the Pooh. Did you ever really leave Disney?
No, I'm still there. I'm still working for Disney. I do a lot of things. We did a stage version of Jungle Book in Chicago and hope to get that up again in a while. Yeah, I'm also working on Bedknobs and Broomsticks as a stage musical, so there are a number of projects that I'm working on very much with Disney.
So good. That leads me into my next question. Over the years, you've written for motion pictures, television shows, theme parks, and for stage musicals. Is it all the same for you, or is there a different mindset when you're writing for the different media outlets?
Oh, no, no. It's all the same thing. The best possible song for the best possible situation, and give it everything you got every time out of the bag. If it's a little ditty, a little trivial song, or if it's a heart-rending ballad, give it everything you got.
Regardless what the where it's going to be.
Absolutely,
right.
And I have no different mindset when I'm writing for stage, television, animated film, or live action.
Got it. Was it Walt Disney who brought music to animation, thereby introducing musical scores to children at an early age? Because
many times we hear this music.
The
one that actually did Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs.
Right.
Think about it. What a remarkable landmark that was. Great score, great songs, wonderful, wonderful animation, incredible characters, a great story. Wonderful.
Do you think the children really understood that they're hearing these orchestras and really understanding orchestra music and thinking they've never heard that, but they've been listening to it so long in animation that it's just they're learning about orchestra music through these children's animated movies?
Well, I think they're getting a sample of really great, great music. And then as they get older, I think they start realizing this is actually symphony orchestras. These are wonderful musicians playing this stuff. It's all like an opening the door. In the beginning, it's like a gestalt. They just hear it in one, and they think that's all the same thing. But then all of a sudden, they realize it's not only the singer who's singing words and singing to you, but it's this wonderful background music that's coming at them, and they realize that this is special. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a discovery thing, unless somebody points it out to them. But otherwise, it's just a natural discovery as they mature.
Is there a song out there you still want to write that you want to get out? Is there something bubbling in your head that you're is standing?
Yes, there is. There always is. I mean, I don't think I'll ever quit. I love writing, and I love writing songs if I can be pleased with them. And I'm always working on one project or another. I have another show I'm working on with another fellow, and I'm very proud of that. And I'm working on some instrumentals. I've done a number of instrumental albums. It's just fun. I do a lot of work. And I certainly enjoy my work. It's like I never worked. It's my hobby. I just love doing it.
Well, Mr. Sherman, I want to thank you for all the wonderful music you've provided our nation and the world, and your brother's music as well, for such great entertainment and time today to allow me to ask you so many questions that I've wondered for a very long time. Thank you so much.
You're welcome, and thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That was KVCR's Lillian Vasquez in conversation with songwriter Richard Sherman to wrap up another edition of KVC Arts. Thanks again to Richard Sherman, as well as to poet Eli Henley and painter Zara Kant. Here at KVCR, thanks to Benjamin Perper, Lillian Vasquez, Rick Dulock, and Sharina Watt. Music beds and themes heard on KVC Arts composed and performed by Sean Longstreet, so thanks to Sean as well. Many past KVC Arts programs can be found through iTunes, NPR One, Spotify, and Google Play. And all past shows are at kvcrnews.org/arts. Also, you can tell your smart speaker to play KVCR. I'm David Fleming. Thanks especially to you for listening and for your support.